Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Rebels in Arms, Black Resistance and the Fight for Freedom in the Anglo-Atlantic by Justin Iverson. Narrated by Bill Andrew Quinn. Note on terminology. I have taken care to use the adjectival phrase enslaved instead of slave to refer to the unfreed people of the African diaspora featured in this work. Conversely, I have tried to refer to people who owned enslaved people as slave owners or slave holders instead of the term master. I believe it is important to highlight this power dynamic and restore agency and humanity to people kept in bondage in the Atlantic world. However, out of sheer preference for greater lexical diversity and style, I do use the terms slave and occasionally master throughout this work. Additionally, while the term rebel typically refers to enslaved people who were resisting their own enslavement featured in this work, in Chapter 1, I occasionally use this term to refer to Nathaniel Bacon's forces more broadly, which contemporaries and historians since have often employed. Likewise, I sometimes refer to Confederate forces in Chapter 6 as rebels. Finally, the soldiers and slave rebels in this work were both African and American-born. Some were also biracial. In cases where it is probable that some slave soldiers were born in Africa, the Caribbean, or mainland North America, I therefore use African and African American to denote their origin. I do not, however, use these terms to signify acculturation or creolization among these people. More broadly, I also use the terms blacks or black people interchangeably with African and African American. The term whites, whites, W capitalized, is also used generally to refer to European colonists and American-born people of European descent. For consistency, I also capitalize all racial and ethnic groups as proper nouns. Finally, I use the terms uprising, rebellion, revolt, and insurrection interchangeably. Introduction. In 1863, Sergeant Prince Rivers, a soldier in the Union Army's all-black 1st South Carolina Volunteer Infantry Regiment, spoke about why he decided to run away from his owner and fight in the Union Army. As a soldier, Rivers told his comrades at St. Helena Island, "Now we can look our old masters in the face. They used to sell and whip us, and we did not dare say one word. Now we ain't afraid, if they meet us, to run the bayonet through them." Rivers also said that he would not stop fighting until all enslaved people in the South were free. Another soldier in the regiment echoed the sentiment later in the war. Corporal Thomas Long delivered a sermon to his companions in 1864, in which he explained that fighting for the Union Army when it promoted black freedom was essential to achieving emancipation. He said that, "If we hadn't become soldiers, all might have gone back as it was before. Our freedom might have slipped through the two houses of Congress, and President Lincoln's 4 years might have passed by and nothing been done for we. But now things can never go back, because we have showed our energy and our courage." Fighting for the First South became a way for enslaved people to attack the chattel slave system and free millions of enslaved black people. While enslaved people like Rivers, Long, and others in the First South finally broke the chattel slave system in the United States, they actually followed in the footsteps of thousands of other enslaved people who took up arms and became soldiers to fight for black freedom for nearly 200 years in the Anglo-Atlantic world. They followed the paths of people like Billy and Lally and their children Cressy, Flora, Beck, Cynthia, and Nero. The family had run away from their owner, John Forbes, in northern Florida to fight with the British Army and Seminole Maroons at the fort at Prospect Bluff, which had become a stronghold for Maroons to defend the Gulf Coast borderlands from American enslavers between 1812 and 1816. Veterans of the First South were also following in the footsteps of people like Private Hippolyte, an enslaved soldier of the 8th West India Regiment, WIR, who participated in a massive mutiny in the British colony of Dominica in April 1802, and later joined the island's Maroons. Soldiers of the First South carried the torch of still others before them who used military service to fight for black freedom. They trailed people like slave soldiers in Lord Dunmore's Ethiopian regiment, who engaged their former owner, Colonel Joseph Hutchings, at the Battle of Kemp's Landing near Norfolk on November 15, 1775, or like 70-year-old Jane Thompson, who fled from owner Robert Tucker in Norfolk in 1776 to join Dunmore's lines during the American Revolutionary War. Soldiers in the First South succeeded people like Francisco Menendez, an enslaved man who took up arms for the Yamasees and Spanish against English enslavers in Carolina during the Yamasee War in 1715 to 1717. Finally, they shadowed hundreds of enslaved people who took up arms for Nathaniel Bacon in exchange for freedom during his rebellion in Virginia in 1676 to 1677. Enslaved black people took up arms and fought in nearly every colonial conflict in early British North America. They fought in Nathaniel Bacon's rebellion in Virginia in 1676, in the Tuscarora and Yamasee Wars in the Carolinas and Georgia in the second decade of the 18th century, in Florida during the War of Jenkins' Ear in 1740, in Virginia and Pennsylvania in the French and Indian War from 1754 to 1763, and throughout North America and the Caribbean during the American Revolutionary War, among many other conflicts. They participated in several other armed engagements elsewhere in the British Atlantic in the 17th, 18th, and early 19th centuries as well. They attacked enemy positions in the 16th century, and they defended Caribbean colonies from French, Spanish, and Dutch assaults as early as 1640. They helped colonial militias fight Maroons by the early 18th century in Jamaica, and they routinely assisted slaveholders in stopping slave insurrection. By the early 19th century, thousands of enslaved soldiers in the British Army in North and South America, in the Caribbean, and in Africa for various interests of the British Empire. They often fought for their owners as ordered or in hopes of being manumitted for faithful and good service. Others were sometimes forced to arm and participate in armed conflict, and some used the opportunity that violent conflict produced to run away from slavery. Still others turned coat and served for their master's enemies. Slave soldiers fought for every other European colonial empire in the Atlantic as well, and they took part in some of the first conquests in the Caribbean and the Americas. During the rise of Atlantic slave trading, they also guarded European slave forts along the Atlantic coast in Africa, and they served to protect the developing slave trade. Yet they also fought against the slave trade in Africa, and many were enslaved due to war and armed conflict in the continent. Their role with respect to white empires built on black slavery in the Atlantic has perplexed historians for decades, who have studied how and why enslaved soldiers participated in conflicts that seemingly reinforced white colonization and black slavery throughout the littoral. Historians have long been familiar with some of these soldiers' exploits since as early as the mid-19th century, when abolitionists like William Cooper Nell wrote some of the first histories of enslaved people's contributions to early American war efforts. Since the modern civil rights movement, there has been a steady surge in research on free black and enslaved soldiers in early America, and scholars have further sought to demonstrate how black soldiers contributed to American military history. Conversely, throughout the history of slavery in North America, enslaved people took up arms to rebel against Atlantic chattel slavery and attack their owners. While successful rebellion was a rare exception, during insurrection, some rebels successfully ran away and formed maroon communities in outlying swamps, mountains, and forests, where they could evade their former owners and escape the horrors of chattel slavery. Scholars have studied slave rebellions and maroons in the Atlantic world for more than a century to better understand the nature of Atlantic slavery and to assess its impact on the people who endured it. A new wave of scholarship has emerged in the last 25 years that reconceptualizes the frequency and scope of slave rebellions in maroon societies and has tied resistance in both to warfare. While some have found slave revolts in conventional warfare, others have asked what slave rebellions meant for enslaved Africans and have tied rebellion to war by highlighting how enslaved rebels fought like soldiers. These episodes thus revealed that slave resistance could be acts of war against slavery, and that enslaved Africans repeatedly made war against the Atlantic slave system. In short, military histories of early America and the British Atlantic, histories of slave rebellions and Maroons, and interpretations of warfare in the African diaspora and transatlantic slave trade remain disconnected, but scholars have begun to flesh out warfare in enslaved resistance movements, while also finding resistance in times of war and armed conflict. Thus, an emerging swell of scholars seeks to further our understanding of the relationship between resistance and war, and how slaves interpreted and acted on these opportunities. This work contributes to this new surge of scholarship to show how slave soldiers interpreted these violent upheavals in ways that challenge us to reconsider how we think about large-scale armed conflict and black resistance. It brings military histories of early America, histories of slave rebellions and Maronage, and histories of warfare in the African diaspora together to show that slave soldiers and plantation slave and Maroon rebels were sometimes one and the same. How did some slave and Maroon soldiers in early America and the British Atlantic turn colonial and imperial warfare and rebellion into opportunities to achieve and preserve their own freedom? How did these goals or methods of slave soldiers involved in armed resistance change over time from the early period of establishing the Atlantic slave system to the Age of Emancipation? Did armed resistance differ in the British Atlantic based on geography or in conflicts involving Native Americans? Did armed resistance differ when other European imperial powers were involved? This book examines approximately 200 years of enslaved people taking up arms in times of war and rebellion to resist the Atlantic chattel slave system. It investigates 6 cases in early America and the British Atlantic in which slaves took up arms and participated as soldiers in conflicts traditionally thought to have been fought over colonial or imperial policy, or as Indian Wars. In each conflict, slave soldiers and Maroons took up arms for Anglo-Americans and served as soldiers to fight for them to serve various interests in the British Empire and the United States. But in each conflict, some soldiers also fought against their owners. To be sure, still others fought for other interests, and perspectives were diverse. We know a lot about these conflicts from white and Native American perspectives, but we know much less about how all enslaved black soldiers and Maroons interpreted them. Yet each case captures a moment of armed resistance in the Anglo-American Atlantic and shows how many enslaved people and Maroons viewed soldiering or the process of becoming a soldier or armed military combatant. In each case, some slave and Maroon soldiers used military conflict as an avenue to challenge the slave system and turned war and rebellion into battles about black liberation. In each case, they used armed conflict to further slave insurrection or Maroon war. At times, black soldiers took up arms in exchange for freedom, often running away to their owners' imperial and Native American enemies to further challenge the slave system. At other times, they created conflict or allied themselves with forces willing to promote black freedom, albeit often on a limited basis. The cases thereby give us a better sense of the relationship between war and slavery and how people living in difficult or desperate circumstances mobilize for conflicts seemingly unrelated to them. They give us a better sense of how slavery influenced war and how war can transform slavery, because in the Anglo-Atlantic world, armed conflict often raised the specter of the future of chattel slavery and freedom from it. The cases give us a better sense of soldiering as a form of resistance to slavery, while examining enslaved soldiers also gives us a deeper understanding of the meaning and experience of slavery and war altogether. These many thousands of people who risked everything to acquire and protect their individual freedom and end slavery laid the groundwork for the freedom of many others. It also meant that military service developed a special meaning for African Americans in their struggles for freedom, equality, and opportunity, especially in the United States. This work uses case studies to examine how slave soldiers fought in early America and in the British Atlantic. Each case represents a different type of armed conflict that slave soldiers used to fight for freedom in various places in the Atlantic world. These conflicts include internal imperial rebellions, wars with Native American allies and enemies, conflicts with other European allies and enemies, and civil war. Each case also represents a different type of military service that slave soldiers used in various places in the Atlantic world. They fought in colonial militias, in professional armies in times of crisis, and in professional armies during times of relative peace. The cases provide comparative analytical value in and of themselves, and part of the contribution this work makes is with its comparative Atlantic analysis. I compare and contrast each case to other incidents of slave insurrection and maroon warfare throughout the Atlantic littoral and over time. Although there are some general patterns across time and space, I try to compare each case to incidents of rebellion and marinage that were closely related in terms of both geography and time. Each case represents a collective act of slave resistance to Atlantic Channel slavery, similar in form to slave rebellion or maroon war. While each case in this work represents collective resistance, each case does not represent an entire history of many slaves, maroons, and free soldiers who participated in each conflict. Indeed, black perspectives were diverse, and even when some enslaved soldiers turned warfare into opportunities to resist chattel slavery, others chose not to do so or fought for other reasons and interests. Additionally, the cases do not represent a comprehensive history of the black military experience in the Anglo-Atlantic. Nonetheless, these cases are a significant part of that story as well as the long road to abolition. The comparative framework is also grounded in a basic anatomization of Atlantic slave revolts that gives more meaning to some general patterns of militarized slave insurrection against which each case study can be measured. While Atlantic slave revolts changed over time and were affected by the creolization of enslaved rebels and their appropriation of revolutionary ideology, among other things, there were at least four static features of slave insurrection that helped make sense of the Atlantic chattel slave system and how slave soldiers responded to similar conditions. These features include collective participation, material deprivation, goals and objectives, and tactics and methods. The first feature that characterized Atlantic slave revolts was the collective participation of enslaved rebels. Slave revolts were collective endeavors, and they occurred on a less frequent basis than other individual and collective acts of resistance. Exactly how many rebels constituted an uprising or what their proportion of a larger enslaved population actually meant has been the subject of debate among slaveholders and modern historians alike. What is at least clear is that slave rebellion required more than just one or two conspirators to form, and when they erupted, generally only a small proportion of the total enslaved population decided to participate. Rarely did rebels represent a majority of the total enslaved population, and in many cases, the participation rate hovered around 10 to 20% of the total local, state, or colonial slave population. For example, during the massive uprising in St. John in 1733, approximately 10% of the island's slave population participated in the rebellion. Likewise, census data show approximately 8% of slaves in the German coast area participated in the large revolt outside New Orleans in 1811, and roughly 10% of slaves in Southampton County participated in Nat Turner's 1831 Virginia Rebellion. Rebels' decisions to take part were based on a multitude of factors, not least being their desire to use violence and risk their lives, since almost all rebellions ultimately failed and rebels died. Slave soldiers, like plantation rebels, mobilized collectively and only significantly challenged the slave system when they fought collectively. Most historians of slavery in the Atlantic, Ottoman, and Indian Ocean worlds now agree that material deprivation also often influenced precisely where, when, and why slaves revolted. When owners shifted the economic burden to their slaves or increased their work requirements, slaves were more likely to rebel. If war or natural disasters destroyed homes and crops, or if enslaved people were starving, they were more likely to rebel. If they endured more physical abuse or maltreatment from their owners, they were more likely to rebel. The absence of some of these conditions in the Ottoman and Indian Ocean worlds helps explain the absence of major slave insurrections in those regions, unlike what happened in the Atlantic littoral. Thus, material deprivation was often present before militarized slave revolts occurred. For example, in 1639 in St. Kitts, slaves conspired to rise up because of their brutal treatment. In Barbados in 1765, a violent storm destroyed hundreds of homes and killed several people in the summer before a rebel conspiracy there. Similarly, in 1691 and 1692, a disease swept away sailors, planters, and slaves on the island and created high mortality rates and truly deplorable conditions before the 1692 conspiracy there. Before the 1733 St. John Uprising, a drought ravaged the island and a hurricane destroyed food and crops. In Berbice in 1763, dysentery wreaked havoc on the enslaved population before the enormous rebellion there. To be sure, material suffering was relative, and there were numerous cases in which the conditions for enslaved people had not bottomed out before the insurrections erupted. For example, several uprisings broke out during holidays when enslaved people were often on reduced work schedules or enjoyed larger food rations. Deprivation could also be a personal motivator in ways that differed from general economic conditions. Sometimes enslaved people formed insurrection because of their own personal sufferings that did not affect the larger enslaved population in the same ways. These cases also represent just a drop in the bucket of the thousands of Atlantic slave insurrections, but they comport with a general feature of Atlantic slave revolts also noted in each chapter. Conditions were harsher for enslaved people in the Atlantic world than in other systems of slavery around the globe, which encouraged insurrections that were unique to the Atlantic littoral. When these conditions worsened even further, either generally or personally, rebellions were often more likely to occur. This was true, too, for enslaved people who took up arms and became soldiers to resist the chattel system. Another feature that typified Atlantic slave revolts was the goals and objectives that slave rebels shared when they mobilized. Rebels generally desired to achieve freedom or some form of relief from the chattel system, either for themselves or to larger ends. Rebels in the Stono Rebellion were calling out liberty as they marched from plantation to plantation in Carolina in 1739. Likewise, Gabriel and his followers planned on carrying a flag with the words Death or Liberty inscribed on it in Virginia in 1800. Slave rebels who created maroon communities in Jamaica, Saint-Domingue, or Brazil removed themselves from planter control altogether, even though chattel slavery survived nearby. Slave soldiers, like slave rebels, fought to achieve freedom for themselves, and in some cases, freedom for everyone in the immediate area. While not every Atlantic slave rebellion was necessarily violent, militarized rebellions generally followed a basic pattern that relied on military violence to achieve rebel goals. Enslaved rebels usually met in advance to rise up. Even spontaneous rebellions required some degree of coordination. Once rebels banded together, they usually killed a planter and white overseers on one plantation and ransacked the house to gather weapons. In most cases, acquiring firearms or even cannons at these early stages of insurrection was vital. When the rebels were fully armed, either with firearms or other weapons such as farm implements, knives, and lances, they moved to nearby plantations to recruit more slaves and kill more enemies. They often moved in military formations and used military tactics and procedures to further their goals. Military violence became central to accomplishing their objectives. In most cases, they forced other enslaved people to join them by threatening to kill them or destroy their homes if they did not participate. In many militarized revolts, rebels also relied on military oathing ceremonies that also solidified allegiance and commitment to combat. Such oaths were often rooted in African military traditions. Once mobilized, if the rebels were lucky, they could fight their way to mountains, forests, or swamps to escape white retribution. If they were unfortunate, they often faced white militias and pitched battles that resulted in the utter destruction of the rebel forces. In many ways, militarized rebellions demonstrated some of the same tactics and violence that slave soldiers chose to resist the chattel system. While the comparative framework in this book uses revolts and maroon wars throughout the Atlantic for analysis, it examines cases of slave soldiers only in the United States and British realm of the Atlantic world, because military slavery and the manner in which whites were willing to arm free and enslaved black people differed in the Anglo-Atlantic than elsewhere in the literal, or in the rest of the British global empire. Indeed, historians have shown that, unlike the Spanish, Portuguese, French, and others, British colonists and imperial authorities were reluctant to permit free black and enslaved people to take up arms and service in military units in the Atlantic world. While every European empire employed enslaved soldiers on the coast of Africa to protect slave forts and defend their slave trading operations, British colonists became reluctant to employ slave soldiers on the other side of the Atlantic and to develop independent free and slave military units like their European counterparts. Enslaved soldiers participated in Spanish conquests in the Americas in the 16th century, and formal all-black militias were formed in almost every Spanish colony by the 17th century. Aside from protecting Spanish colonists from Native American, British, French, and Dutch attacks, they also fought Maroons and tracked runaway slaves. Similarly, enslaved soldiers fought for Portuguese interests in all-black units like the Terço do Gente Preta in northeastern Brazil in the mid-17th century. Enslaved soldiers were also used to fight the Palmares Maroons as early as the 1640s. The Dutch too employed slave soldiers in the mid-17th century in Brazil, and they even considered conscripting African veterans to serve in the militia in Curaçao near the end of the 17th century. Slaves were definitely serving in the island's militia by the first decade of the 18th century, while they also served in militias in Suriname in the early 18th century. Slaves and free blacks served in their own militias in the French Atlantic by the early 18th century as well, such as in the Maréchaussée in Saint-Domingue in 1721. A permanent free black militia existed in French Louisiana by 1739. The Danish also established an all-black corps on St. John as early as 1721. But in the British Atlantic, colonial authorities more often prohibited free black and enslaved people from arming or serving in colonial militias. To be sure, English privateers like Sir Francis Drake relied on Maroon soldiers for help fighting against the Spanish in Panama as early as the late 16th century, and in times of crisis, English colonists did enlist the help of enslaved soldiers by the mid-17th century. By 1640, slaves helped the English defend Providence Island near present-day Colombia from a Spanish attack, and some slaves helped the English fight in Santo Domingo in 1654. In the 1660s, slaves were first incorporated into the Barbados militia in what may be the earliest case of slave soldiers in the British Atlantic. The 1681 Militia Act in Jamaica also required black people to help defend the colony, while Deputy Governor Charles Lilton proclaimed Maroon leader Juan de Bolas to be the leader of some sort of Maroon militia in the 1660s and 1670s. But all too often, enslaved people did not serve as soldiers, but as military laborers, and they were often prohibited from carrying firearms. All too often, they returned to their previous status once peace returned, and permanent free black and slave militias did not develop as early or as widely as they did in French, Spanish, Portuguese, or Dutch colonies. Blackshot slave soldiers who fought against Maroons in Jamaica did not muster until the 1720s during the First Maroon War, but Jamaican colonists still recruited Indians to fight the rebels throughout the conflict. Once peace was reached with the Maroons essentially made black units obsolete, as the Maroons promised to provide military assistance in case of foreign invasion and slave insurrection. While Maria Boletino has recently demonstrated that English colonists were willing to use slave soldiers earlier than previously thought, The general pattern persists that British colonists only used slave soldiers in times of crisis and conflict throughout the 17th and 18th centuries. This contrasts significantly with other European imperial forces in the Americas who had been using large numbers of enslaved black people for military purposes since the late 17th century.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?